Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. And I'll be speaking today with brain scientist Jill Botti Taylor, who at 37 suffered a massive stroke from which she has fully recovered. Her book about that experience, My Stroke of Insight, has been a bestseller, and her 2008 TED Talk has received 27 million views. Her second book, Whole Brain Living, expands on the lessons of her first, and you can learn more at Dr., that's Dr., Jill Taylor, Dr. Jill, J-I-L-L, Taylor, T-A-Y-L-O-R, Dr. Jill Taylor, all one word, .com. On Free Forum, we explore the lives and the work and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at politics, economics, environment, science, health, culture, and more, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. The show airs on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and on kpfk.org Thursdays at 4 p.m. Pacific, and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on tunein.com. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Podomatic.com, most major podcast sites, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally, all one word, terrencemcnally.net. Now, on May 3rd, approximately 5 weeks ago, my wife had a stroke. She's 63. There were no signs, no warning signs that there was any imminent danger of such a thing. And just to reassure you, she is fine physically, but she has language problems, some data processing problems, a little bit of vision. The big thing is that this, of course, is life-changing, certainly for her and also for me. We count ourselves lucky that in dealing with her recovery from this stroke, which is both of our full-time job at this point, you can see even my podcast this week is part of that job. We feel lucky that we didn't have a small child we had to care of, or a disabled partner or parent that was our responsibility, or some critically important job. She had a career as a sitcom television writer. Well, if this had happened in the middle of the season, that would be out the window. I've had various critical jobs from which I'm pretty much retired, except for this podcast. So we are free, really, to devote ourselves to her recovery. And I will share that one of the most surprising and rewarding things is that the first few days, week and a half, actually were almost better than life before, in that our connection was suddenly so necessary and so strong, and little moments of triumph would bring us such joy that we realized we were experiencing more moments of joy than we had been in our regular lives, where you pass each other, you know, and you do whatever you do. Suddenly every moment, everything was precious. And that was a deeply moving and affirming thing. Now, as I said, about 5 weeks in, it's a little more challenging. It's the progress in those first few days was quick, but now it's much more incremental. A little this, a little that, and the moments of frustration can be all the more frustrating. And that sort of state of, why am I still like this? You know, when am I going to be myself again? Those sorts of questions. Although I will say that both of us kind of know at some level that she is herself, and that herself is the deeper self that's now dealing with what fate has dealt her. So our daily lives consist of speech therapy, some vision therapy. Both we go to speech therapists and vision therapists, and then we do therapy at home, and then she rests. Rest is really a big part of it, because your brain has, and I will tell you, your brain has to work very hard to repair itself, to build new pathways and so on. But it's also incredibly tiring for me, having to sort of, if you imagine yourself kind of playing charades 15 hours a day. It's really tiring. I don't have the late night energy that I used to have. So it's practice, it's rest, And then as I sort of am describing, it's minute by minute navigation of what comes next and how does this work and how do we make sense of this and so on. And before we start the interview with Dr. Taylor, I want to just say two pieces of advice. One, we'll talk about in more detail in the interview, which is be aware of the signs of stroke. And if you see them, drop everything and head for the emergency room. That's the number one. Number two, and this I give to everyone, and they're kind of going, oh my God, you're right. Share your critical information with somebody, with your partner or a best friend. What are your passwords? How do you pay your bills? What are your bank accounts? What are those things? I'm going to get emotional a few times during this, but if you woke up tomorrow and you couldn't remember or you couldn't process, how would your life go on? And you don't want to be in that situation. What's happened is critical enough. You don't want to make it worse by being unable to meet the needs that you have every day. So that's if you take nothing else from this, take that so that no one a week from now is without this, because this sort of thing, and it's not just this, car accidents, there's all sorts of things that can happen that suddenly you are unable to do what you were doing, and you don't want to have critical secrets that only you know the answer to. Okay. Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor is a Harvard-trained and published neuroanatomist who in 1996, at the age of 37, experienced a rare form of stroke that left her unable to walk, talk, read, write, or recall any of her life. It took 8 years to recover all physical, emotional, and thinking abilities. She's the author of the best-selling My Stroke of Insight, A Brain Scientist's Personal Journey, as well as Whole Brain Living, The Anatomy of Choice and the Four Characters That Drive Our Life. Her foundation, Jill Bolte Taylor Brains, provides educational services and programs related to the advancement of brain awareness, injury prevention, and neurological recovery. She's an active member of NAMI, N-A-M-I, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and remains the national spokesperson for the Harvard Brain Tissue Resource Center, or the Harvard Brain Bank. Welcome, Jill Bolte Taylor, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Parents, I'm so happy to be with you. And, you know, some of those points that you made are so important. And I'm going to go right to absolutely make a list of all of your bank accounts, all of your critical data. Put it in a safety deposit box if you have to. Give it a copy of it to a trusted friend. But write it down, even for yourself. It is so important, because when devastation happens, you're the one that it has been devastated, then your whole world can really fall apart if you don't have people who can come in and help you. And the level of stress that this will put on you and your brain, and if you're not in a state of wellness to be able to share that, then, oh my gosh, you don't want that stress on top of the stress of the physical illness. So you're absolutely right. It's so important to really prepare for, you know, the unknown.
Yeah. And you know, and I say it to everyone, but especially us who are getting older, the things happen and we don't have control. And we've got these very complicated, complex lives. That information that we're talking about sharing would have been much less 10, 15 years ago. It's like we've accumulated all these secrets, as I say, and we've got to share them, so that we're not alone when and if something like that happens. Let me tell listeners, by the way, we're recording this conversation Thursday, June 9th. Okay, Jill, I always begin the show really trying to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. And often I ask people, you know, what was your path? Well, much of our conversation is going to deal with your experience of the stroke and your recovery. But could you tell us a bit about your path prior to the stroke? And feel free to go back and mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing.
Yeah. So I was, I grew up in Indiana, and I had a brother who, I still have a brother who's 18 months older than I am. And I also have an older brother, but you know how siblings are, kids go everywhere together. You know, the family's the pack, and now we go everywhere. So the middle child was my constant companion. And it turned out that I started noticing as a child, 5, 6, 7 years old, that we were very different in how we perceived our experiences. And ball in the yard, and the ball goes out into the street, and one of us goes running after that ball. And my mother, Gigi, watches this, and she yells and she screams and she hollers. And I thought she was, you know, petrified, whereby my brother interpreted her behavior as anger. And it was like these little misses, all these little misses in how we were processing reality. So I became fascinated with us and eventually grew up to be a brain scientist. And by later in life, my brother was eventually diagnosed with a brain disorder, schizophrenia. So I was then teaching and performing research on the postmortem brains of individuals who had been diagnosed with various mental illnesses. And this was a very fulfilling life for me because I was trying to help people like my brother. And then I woke up one day at the age of 37, and I had a major hemorrhage in the left half of my own brain. And over the course of 4 hours, I watched my brain deteriorate through the eyes of a neuroscientist who thinks in terms of cells and circuitry. This was my area of expertise. I visualized over that course of 4 hours what was actually happening at a cellular level, where eventually after that morning, I could not walk, talk, read, write, or recall any of my life. I became completely vegetative in a woman's body. And that was a profound experience through the eyes of a scientist. And although I lost my left hemisphere and its ability to think rationally and interact with the external world, I also lost the emotions of my entire past, any fears of the future. I lost all linearity of time. I lost me, the individual, Jill Bolte Taylor. That Jill Bolte Taylor died that day. And yet I was still conscious, but I existed in the experience of the present moment, which is what that right hemisphere has to offer. And then it took 8 years for me to completely recover until I had all my language. I had a new identity. I could think across time with a past and a future. I got the boundaries of where do I begin and where do I end back, all those things that beautiful left hemisphere does. So I regained that ability. And then I ended up writing a memoir, My Stroke of Insight, Brain Scientist Personal Journey. And I gave a TED Talk. It was the first TED Talk that ever went viral on the internet. And then I met Oprah, and I became one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential, and life exploded. I had a new life. So it's been a very meaningful and an amazing experience to have the ability to lose half of my brain, literally, and then to have to use the half that I still had in order to rebuild the skills of that left hemisphere. It's been an incredible journey.
Very good. I want to give people some background information that is not just true about you or my wife or anyone else, but what is a stroke? And as far as I understand it, there are two types, the ischemic and the hemorrhage. Tell people what a stroke is and how common they are.
So stroke is very common. It's the number one disabler in our society. We generally have between 750 and 800,000 strokes a year in just the United States. It can happen in the womb. It can happen, on the deathbed and anywhere in between. A lot of people think that this is, for people who are 60 and older. And it's like, no, it's not. Literally half the strokes happen before the age of 60.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's very, very common, relatively speaking. So what happens during stroke is the blood and first of all, the brain is made up of cells, these beautiful cells, and the primary cell is the neuron. And packaging around the neurons are other cells called glia, short for glue. And those glial actually form the blood-brain barrier, a physical barrier between the blood vessels and the neurons, because when blood has direct connection with neurons, it's toxic, it's poison, it will kill them or it will completely disable them. So keeping the blood where the blood belongs and keeping the neurons happy is very important if we're going to have normal functioning. So if a blood vessel bursts, has a break in it, then it results in a flooding of the blood and the red blood cells into that space. And it can actually then traumatize the neurons and make them non-functional. So that's a hemorrhagic stroke. The ischemic stroke is when blood vessels are relatively large as they come off the heart, but as they go further away from the heart, they taper and they get smaller and smaller and smaller to the level of where each blood cell lines up by itself at the capillary network. And then a vein attaches, a little venous process, and it essentially absorbs the pulls the liquid out of that capillary network and then takes it back to the heart. So if you have a blood clot that gets thrown anywhere in the body, then they tend to travel throughout the body, traverse through into these arteries, into these tapering little arterioles until they get down to that capillary. And depending on the size of the blood clot, it will cause a blockage in that blood vessel so that the tissue beyond that, which is dependent on those red blood cells for carrying hemoglobin and oxygen, those cells end up not getting their food, essentially, the oxygen. And this is trauma then to those cells. So then those cells become they either die or they become disabled.
Okay, let me just say a couple of things that I hope people understand there, which is, yes, we know, we can feel our carotid artery in our neck. We can feel the pulse in our arm. We, at that point, the blood vessels are large. So that little clot, a few cells that have for some reason clotted together it doesn't matter. It isn't until it gets into a hair thin or smaller vessel that what was fine getting there is now a block.
Right. Well, there can be some pretty big clots.
Oh, yeah, I mean, of course. But I'm saying small clot.
Yeah.
But wouldn't a larger clot affect you before it got to the brain?
Oh, no, not necessarily. Because, again, those carotids are very large blood vessels. And it might be where the carotids go in, and then that first site of bifurcation where they divide, it might block that. In which case, that can be devastating to a very large portion of the brain. So the bigger the clot, the bigger the vessel that gets blocked, the more severe.
The more territory is not getting fed.
Exactly.
Okay, very good.
Yeah. Yeah. And then if you have a hemorrhage can, for example, my hemorrhage that morning ended up being about the size, the blood clot ended up being the size of a golf ball.
Wow.
Well, the size of a fist. And then after 3 weeks, it shriveled up to the size of a golf ball. And then the surgeons had to go in and remove that. So stroke is very common, and it's caused by a lot of different things. And it is absolutely a medical emergency.
Yes. And I want to emphasize, I think we emphasize that, but I want to emphasize that again. What are the signs that someone might be having a stroke?
So I think of the warning signs of stroke as STROKE. To me, that's the easiest way to remember it.
Good.
S stands for speech. If all of a sudden you can't find words, or you're garbling your words, or you just can't think in language at all, S stands for speech or problems with language. It stands for tingling in the body. And it's not always the case, but usually it's only on one side. So you might have tingling in a part of your face, or a tingling in your foot, one of your legs. You might have tingling in an arm somewhere. So T stands for tingling or numbness in the body. And generally one side. You can have it in the midline. So don't, you know, don't say, oh, it's not a stroke because it was on both sides. That's an issue as well. But tingling.
It's more common that it's on one side.
It is. R stands for remember, problems with thinking. All of a sudden, and usually these are acute, all of a sudden things. All of a sudden, you can't think. You can't think straight. You can't remember your child's name. You can't remember not necessarily what you're doing because, you know, that necessarily tends to come with age, or just forgetting somebody's name over a period of time. But if it's somebody really close to you, remembering, if you're having major problems with thinking, that's STR, remember. O stands for off balance, and off balance happens because we end up with paralysis, perhaps on half of the body again. So if all of a sudden I'm off balance or I fall, I trip, it might be because I have paralysis in one of my legs. And so I have weakness there. So that's R. O off balance. K stands for killer headache. Usually there's a killer headache going on. Not always, though. You can have a stroke and it's small enough, like we were talking about those small blood clots, that you don't have that. But if you have a major hemorrhage, then you would probably have a pounding behind one of your eyes that you would really notice. So K stands for killer headache. And then E is eyes, and a problem with vision, because vision actually requires a whole lot of muscles inside. Each eye has six different muscles to move it in all the different directions. So often there is a problem with vision.
And it could be one eye and not the other, right?
Usually, again, I'm going to say usually it's what we call unilateral, but again, not always.
Okay. So in other words, and this is one point I want to make. In other words, the suddenness is part of it, because I have tingling because I've got an issue, right? And that's just constant, and it kind of grew on gradually and so on. It wasn't like suddenly something's happening. So that's part of it. But the other thing is, it's better to, if you see one of these signs, go to the emergency room and be told nothing's wrong.
Right.
And it is to go to assume nothing's wrong and find out you were wrong.
That is so true, because, you know, one of the beauties of, especially if it ends up being a blood clot that has thrown somewhere in the body, we have a 3-hour window of time between the time it happens and the time that there's a special treatment where physicians can actually go in and bust a blood clot up. But they have to do it within that 3-hour period. But if they do, oh my gosh, Terrence, it can be the difference between an enormous problem and trauma to the brain versus a minor one that a person can recover from quickly. But you have to be able to get there and get to the hospital for them to be able to do this treatment. And that you have to have enough time so that they can actually look at a CAT scan to make sure that this was a blood clot instead of a hemorrhage, because they can't just give you a blood clot buster. If you've had a hemorrhage, that will always only make
it worse,
the hemorrhage
right?
bigger.
Yes.
It'll make a hemorrhage. Yeah, it works with a blood clot, but it can kill you if you have a hemorrhage. So they can't just, you know, have you come in and give it to you. They have to come in and test you, see which kind of stroke it is, and then determine a treatment program.
Yeah. And just our experience was once I at first I thought, oh, you know, maybe she's dehydrated. I'll give her some water. I watched her. She was physically fine, feeding the cats, making the tea. So I was fooled a little bit, called her cousin, who's a nurse. Of course, she wasn't home and her message box was full. Luckily, she calls me back a half an hour later, but a half an hour, and says, get to the emergency room immediately. Once I told her what was happening. Yeah. I got to the emergency room. Once we got to the front of the line and I said two sentences, she can't find her words, we're afraid of a stroke.
Yeah.
They rushed her back there.
Oh.
And either honestly or to salve my guilt, they said it had happened in the night, overnight, while she was asleep. And I'll accept their word for it. Because I didn't act immediately. And that's why I think it is so important to get that message out there that people do, that there is a window in which they can minimize the damage.
Oh yeah. This is the difference between major disability and okay within, you know, weeks. If it's a blood clot, they can get to it and bust it up in time.
Yeah. Okay. Let me see. I've heard you tell your stroke experience in a 18-minute TED talk and then in a multi-CD audio book. Let me see if there's anything more that I want to get from it. You found these things happening to you. These you were losing abilities.
Yes.
But you were still conscious. Your comprehension and data processing was working enough that you knew what was happening. How come you didn't think of it as a stroke?
I'm not a neurologist. I'm not an MD. I don't hang out with stroke survivors or people. I see people who have survived a stroke as stroke survivors, and I consider stroke victims the people who died that day. And I'm a neuroanatomist. I study the brain. I'm a PhD. I'm an academic. I had studied stroke, certainly, but my knowledge was book knowledge. It was not, you know, practitioner knowledge. So I was 37 years old. Why on earth? And I was in great physical shape. I was not a smoker. You know, I had zero risk factors for stroke, but I ended up having this major hemorrhage because I was born with a malformation that I didn't know was in my brain. So you know, it wasn't until my right arm went paralyzed that I knew, oh, warning sign of stroke. Oh my gosh, I'm having a stroke. And I would like to say about that experience, and if anybody wants that in detail, my stroke of insight is a, you know, page turner, I hear. Because it'll take you.
It's great as an audiobook in which you do it. You know, sometimes people have actors do it. You do it. So it's right from the horse's mouth.
Yeah, and it takes you literally moment by moment by moment about how I, through the eyes of a scientist, was looking at the experience of what was happening. And, you know, I think one of the most important things was that I lived alone. I woke up, I lived alone. And so even though I could hear my thoughts inside of my mind, and then they would kind of go offline and then come back online, I did not know I could not speak until I tried to speak out loud. And this was really, really important, because if I had tried to speak earlier and it would have been gobbledygook, then I would have known, this is an emergency. I need to call sooner rather than later.
Yes. Oh, I get that.
That's really important. So even if you're alone, you know, look in the mirror, see if there's any paralysis, lift your arms, see if they do okay. See if you feel remotely stable on your legs. If you're having any, then speak out loud, make a phone call, connect, make a connection, and even say, you know, I'm not feeling well. I'm feeling a little weird. Maybe it'll pass. Would you call me back in 10 minutes, you know, and at least make the lifeline connection, because I didn't have that. So it was, it took hours before I actually ended up getting help.
Right. I highly recommend the book and the audio book and so on and the TED talk, but, you actually, you're pretty deep into it when you first try to speak, because you're alone. So right. It's when you are on the phone, as you say, and you spoke what in your brain was to your associate, you know, what shall right. I do? But it actually came out, as you say, woo, 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 woo.
Yeah.
There was nothing there. And then you knew more than you'd known a second earlier. So I think that's very good to, if you experience one of those stroke signals, check out the others. And see if it's if the others are happening as well, which will give
attention.
You a clear. Yeah.
Pay attention and make that lifeline.
Yeah, very, very good. Let me tell people, by the way, okay, we're at about the halfway point. This is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with brain scientist Jill Bolte Taylor, who at 37 suffered a massive stroke from which she has fully recovered. Her book about the experience, My Stroke of Insight, has been a bestseller. Her 2008 TED Talk has received 27 million views. Her second book, Whole Brain Living, expands on the lessons of her first. And you can learn more at drjilltaylor.com, drjilltaylor, all one word, .com. So if you use the term traumatized, I'd also heard people say that basically that whatever part of the brain did not get the oxygen it needed is basically dead. It's off. It has shut off and it's not going to come back on. How is it that we recover?
Well, it is not true that the cells all die. Sometimes when a cell, a neuron, think about a neuron like it's a big star and it's got all these connections to it. Neurons, when they experience this kind of trauma, some of them will die because it is poison to them and they will die. But some of the neurons will actually break off their connections and essentially curl up into little balls and go to sleep.
Oh.
And these are cells that remain dormant, and yet they may be surrounded by dead tissue. So it might be really, really hard to access, get the other neurons. In the meantime, the other neurons that are still alive, they are very excited about trying to see, is anybody in there? Where's our friends? Where's our, you know, family? Where's our colleagues? And so they will go hunting for connection. And that's why sometimes some people can recover things that they had lost, because all of a sudden, actually, it's not a sudden, it takes a long time to have the debris, the blood removed, the dead cells removed, all the stuff in the way removed before neurons can make new connection. But that's the thing about neurons. They're very social creatures, and they're very much like humans in that they want to connect with other neurons. So, you know, what do I do if I get the flu? I curl up in a little ball, right? I cut off my connection. I call up in a little ball. I go to bed. If I'm fortunate, I have loved ones who will bring me chicken noodle soup or whatever I need, keep me, you know, going. But I've shut off. But people keep coming in order to help draw me out and draw me back in when I'm ready. And that's very much like what it's like with neurons. And so that's one way that we can recover. But the other thing is that neurons are constantly rearranging which other neurons they're communicating with. So again, much like people, there are people who I used to talk to 5 years ago all the time, and we had really strong connections. And now I don't speak with them very often, but our connection when we do is still very strong because we've established a very loving relationship, a deep relationship. And neurons kind of are the macro, a microcosm of what we are as the macrocosm. I'm sorry. So, you know, neuroplasticity is this constant rearrangement of these neurons. So that this is actually, we have the ability to learn new information as neurons are rearranging what they know, who they're connected with, and building new networks on a regular basis.
Oh, great, great. So, how likely is one to fully recover? And how does it vary for certain kinds of effects? In other words, there's the physical, right? The semi-paralysis or the paralysis. Then there's the data processing. There's visual. There's language. How likely are each of those to recover fully?
I don't think that's an appropriate question because there's no way to know. I think it depends on what is the severity of the trauma, which cells are traumatized, what's going on with the comparable cells in the opposite hemisphere. Are they inclined to take over functions that have been lost? I think recovery is, and in the back of my stroke of insight, I put 40 recommendations for
recovery. That was one of my next questions. Yes.
And some of that is, you know, what gets in the way of recovery? And I recovered completely. I had an enormous hemorrhage. By anyone's measure, I was completely vegetative on the afternoon of the stroke. I could not walk, talk, read, write, recall any of my life. It did take 8 years for me to recover everything, but I'm a brain scientist and I believed in the ability of the brain to recover if I got out of my own way and I purposely focused. I did really nothing during that 8 year period of time, cognitively and emotionally, than be completely committed to rebuilding my brain. Well, how many people are going to do that? And so, You know, the neurological world looks at Jill Bolte Taylor and says, we don't even know where to begin with the conversation because, you know, nobody recovers like that. And it's like, well, I did recover like that. And I do believe in the ability of the brain to recover, but the person has to be 1,000% committed. They have to balance what they're consuming. Sugar is not a good thing. Caffeine is not a good thing. Sleep is everything. And you have to be willing to recognize neurons have lost their way. It's like a lot, they're like lost children now. And the only way that they're going to learn anything is for us to constantly beyond them, add structure to what we want, get rid of all the noise, and really bring focus to the possibility of recovery. Now, does that mean that anybody can recover? I have no idea. I think everybody is unique. I think everyone's motivation is different. Their knowledge is different. Their interest is different. Their hope is different, and the neurological trauma is unique to every person.
Okay.
But let me end that all by saying Jill Bolte Taylor managed to rebuild from incredible trauma. So I do believe in the ability of the brain to recover, and I believe in that more than I believe in how what we know as a medical community in order to really assist people with complete recovery. I think we're naive.
Okay. You had enormous help from your mother, who moved in with you, I believe, and you both agreed kind of that it was practice, focus, and sleep. And now you, I believe, and some of the things that stunned both me and my wife as we were listening to your book was that you actually drove by yourself at 3 months and went by yourself on a plane trip in under 6 months. I mean,
I did. But then you also have to look at my level of trauma. You have to look at the brain. It's not about the output. It's not about the behavior. It's not that I drove a car. You know, if I've got a motor system, I can drive a car. The problem was I couldn't read the signs that I was going past.
Right.
So I had to learn how to do that, or I had to really have somebody helping me find my way in the world. I mean, those are completely different things.
Exactly.
Every ability we have is because we have brain cells that perform that function. So if those cells are traumatized, then you can't perform that function. But other cells nearby that are still functioning, you still have those abilities because they're functioning. So, I had paralysis on the right side of my body, which I was very fortunate. Paralysis was replaced by weakness very quickly, paresis. But I had to work with my own body for 8 years in order to get perfect balance so that both hemispheres, both sides of my body were working together. Well, I could drive a car because I didn't need to have perfect balance in order to do that. But even if I could drive a car, again, I couldn't read the signs. So, and for me to take a flight, what that meant was my mother made the flight arrangements. She drove me to the airport. She took me to the gate. In those days, you could do that.
Right,
she
right.
said, take this girl and get her off in Tampa. I went to visit a friend. It was a direct flight. And my friend in Tampa was at the other end at the gate to pick me up. So all I had to do was sit on an airplane. So, don't read into it that I was a completely functioning visitor or traveler within 3 months. But the point I will make was that I was willing to do that. I was willing to put myself outside of my comfort zone in order to be able to learn and engage new possibility. And you always have to keep pushing the envelope, or the neurons don't make those new connections. You don't learn new things, and you're not still pushing the envelope, even if you're out of your comfort zone. So risk, a certain level of risk was really important in order for me to push myself to my edge to see, okay, once I get to the edge, I need a whole lot of sleep. shape, but then my edge has been pushed on my overall ability and the interconnection of these beautiful neurons.
It's interesting because when I heard that part, I thought it contradicted what you were saying about total focus on recovery, total focus on regaining, but you considered those activities as being within that total focus.
Oh, absolutely. But that's what I was doing. I mean, by, you know, it's not like, especially in the beginning, it was not like I was, I couldn't read. So I wasn't reading. I wasn't writing. I couldn't write. You know, language was pretty wiped out for me. But you have to keep pushing the envelope of what you can do. And these were things that I could do. And so these were the envelopes that I kept pushing. And the thing about neurons is that the more neurons you keep pushing into a network, then they become even more integrated, and then they allow you to do other things. So it opened up my possibility to continue pushing my envelope in order to learn.
Let me ask you something. My wife and I both notice that you occasionally say, you say, I might have been scared or apprehensive at this moment. So, but in the course of the whole book, there's never like that sort of moments of crushing frustration when you can't get to the next step or you can't find what used to be so accessible to you. And I've got to say that for both of us, we have those moments. Did you really not have those moments, or are they just not in your account?
I was not greedy. You're being greedy. Why on earth should you be able to have a whole brain working perfectly and beautifully? Why? What? Who deserves that? Who has earned that? What right do you have to say, oh my God, this is the minimum I'll accept of perfection? It's like, honey, I didn't die that day, period. I didn't die that day. And when you don't die and you come up out of that with a level of gratitude for everything that you have, there's no place for greed.
Well, I must say, by the way, what resonates is that Teresa has said, for the first few days, I was so joyful because I hadn't died.
Yeah.
And now 5 weeks in, the not having died is kind of taken for granted more.
And isn't that sad? Can she wiggle her toes? Oh my God.
Can she? It turns out literally it's sad.
Oh my God. Can she smell? Oh my God. Does she have eyes that see? Oh my God. We get into trouble when we don't have any gratitude for the bigger picture of what we are as a living being. And now it's all about, we focus on the tiny little collection of cells that don't work. And that's where we get in trouble, I think, with cancer also. If we end up getting a cancer or some kind of a disability and all the energy and focus goes into what we don't have, it's like, there's so much more you could lose.
You know, and what message are you giving your organism when that's your focus?
And why wouldn't you focus on the beauty and on the what we have instead of giving all the energy, all the cognitive and emotional energy to what's absent instead of the abundance? You know, and people say, oh, you know, I don't have anything. And I'm going, can you wiggle your toes? Oh, my God. Can you speak with language? Oh, my God. Can you see with your eyes? Oh, my God. Do you have people in your life and you know you can remember their name? Oh, my God. Seems to me you have an abundance, but you're just not choosing to look at it. So I would say to any stroke survivor, we're in a hurry, but our neurons are not. And neurons are like little children. And if you want your little neurons to do better, then treat them well. Treat them with gratitude and be grateful for the ones that you have and for what they do. It's been 25 years now since that stroke, and I still wake up every moment. And as soon as I wake up, my mind goes to, oh my gosh, I'm alive. I'm still alive. I get to wake up again. I woke up again because there's a little group of cells inside of our brain that wakes us up. And if they don't do their job, we exist in a state of coma. It's like, oh my gosh, why wouldn't I wake up and say thank you? Oh my gosh, thank you for doing your job today. And then eyes, I can see, I can hear, I can smell, I have mobility, I can move, I have a mind. Oh my gosh, I have a voice, I can remember your name. Oh my gosh, there's a million things to focus on in gratitude. And it's kind of like, if you say to those cells, well, I can't do this and I can't do that, what kind of motivation is it for those cells to come around because you have no gratitude? You're being greedy. So that's, I'm sorry, what I have to say about that.
No, that was a good rant. That was a good rant, Jill. I mean, in other words, one thing that my wife came in and told me today, she said, wow, the sparrows are just loving the bird feeder today.
How beautiful.
You know, exactly.
How beautiful. Yeah. Focus on the positive and they'll grow.
Because I mean, I'll share with you something very personal, which is that one of the things I do very often when I first wake up is say thank you for this moment. And I start from there. And when we got married the last day of 2014, in her vows, Teresa said that was one of the things she loved about me.
Right.
I was thankful for being alive.
Yeah, you start the day with gratitude. Every moment, every ability we have, be grateful. You know, it's not just when you sit down and look at a beautiful meal in front of you. It's like, oh my God, I have eyes that can see it. I can smell it. I can touch it. I can eat it. I'm alive. I'm alive. Oh my gosh. And to live life with that awe and that wonder. And it's like, that is living. And otherwise, what are you doing? What's complaining? What's worrying? What's all that? You know, it's like, it's a choice. We have the power to choose who and how we want to be. Why on earth wouldn't we choose to be grateful for what we have?
And that sort of takes us to what I think you talk about as the insights in your stroke of insight, your discovery, if you will, of your right brain and its experience of life and consciousness. Because as we talked about way at the start, it often affects one side or the other. And the left brain, I'm going to let you take over here, but the left brain has a very different way of functioning and provides very different gifts, if you will, than the right brain. Yeah. And it, depending on which side, Teresa's, like yours, was left brain. So talk a little bit about, I mean, that's obviously one of the things that is the biggest insight you got, was what's there for us at any moment in our right brain.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting when we think about psychology. You know, I did have a degree in psychology, but I'm really a neuroanatomist. I study the brain at a cellular level. And in psychology, if you look at Carl Jung and you look at the four archetypes, the primary four archetypes, in his understanding, one of those four archetypes is our rational thinking conscious brain, and yet our emotional brain and our whatever else is going on in that subconscious is all in our unconscious brain. And so in the world of psychology, really, we are aware of what's going on in a quarter of our brain. And, you know, that was great and interesting. But then because I experienced that left hemisphere and that rational brain that was my conscious brain go offline, I didn't go unconscious. I simply lost the inhibition of that conscious brain to say, well, this is my unconscious brain. And it's like, well, it's all I had. And so as I lost the left hemisphere, I gained the right hemisphere. And if you look at the human brain, we have emotion in both hemispheres and we have thinking in both hemispheres at a neuroanatomical level. This is the development of the mammalian nervous system. So I simply got to see, well, what is the emotion of the right here, right now, present moment, because that's all I had was the present moment. And also in that left hemisphere, which gives us a past and a future, it gives me the individual, an ego. I am Jill Bolte Taylor, and I'm a neuroanatomist, and this is where I live, and these are all my details, and these are my relationships in the external world, and this is language, and these are the boundaries of where I begin and where I end. But wipe out all that, And what did I have? I became as big as the universe. I become really focused on the energy of all that is. It's not about me, the individual. There's no time other than the present moment. And it's this magnificent experience of being. But so I essentially landed in the lap of God. But, you know, I was 37 years old. You know, what do I want to do? Be with God for the rest of my physical life. And that didn't seem to make any sense because I'll be that when I'm not here anymore. So I decided to use what I had to rebuild those cells and those circuits and rebuild an ego and an identity and rebuild the boundaries of where I begin and end and regain a new past and a new future, a temporality of time, and rebuild that conscious brain that had the ability to interact in the external world. So simply because of this experience through the eyes of a neuroanatomist, now the whole brain doesn't have to be unconscious, and we can actually learn about these four different characters. Carl Jung was absolutely correct in the four different characters that we have, but Joe Bolte Taylor now has stuck them in the brain, and we can get to know whole brain living. And so that's the book that I wrote and put out last year, is Whole Brain Living, The Anatomy of Choice and the Four Characters That Drive Our Life. So we can actually get to know this conscious and what we would call our unconscious parts of our being, and actually realize, no, they don't have to be unconscious at all. And we can step into those consciousness and those versions of reality instantly in any moment. And that we automatically do periodically throughout our brain, which is why you have this podcast, because you'd like to make the world a better place. And part of making this world a better place, in my mind, is the natural evolution of our human brain. And instead of being skewed to the value structure of me and mine and what is good for me, and balancing with that, we as humanity in relationship to this beautiful planet. So I'm all about whole brain living and really balancing how we are inside of ourselves, how we have the power to choose who and how we want to be in the world, how we live in relationship with one another, and how we overall can help evolve humanity to whatever it is we're supposed to evolve to.
And that glimpse that you were given by the stroke of what it would be like to live in the right brain rather than the left.
It was a little bit bigger than a glimpse.
Oh yes, of course. But I meant it's that thing of like what was obscured, what was obscured before the curtain was drawn.
Exactly.
By the way, I highly recommend a poem by Rumi called Father Reason. Which is basically about that curtain being, you know, drawn and what's revealed when we see behind it. But I want people to know that in the last chapters of My Stroke of Insight, and then I assume, I haven't seen the new book, but I assume the new book builds on that, is you actually say, okay, I got to explore that territory that most of us don't see because we're so busily living our left brain, linear, resume filling, agenda, calendar filling life, that you then say, but there's ways that I can share what I learned with you, and you can actually put it into practice without having to have a stroke.
Absolutely. That's exactly right. Yeah. So in whole brain living, you get to know the anatomy of the brain briefly, and some of the myths about the brain, and about, you know, what's going on in the left thinking tissue, the left emotional tissue, the right emotional tissue, and the right thinking tissue. And each of them exhibit certain skill sets that the others don't have, because that's the beauty of the brain, is that, you know, certain circuits do certain things. And then they actually end up resulting in very specific personalities. And we can get to know our own personalities. We can then have what I call a brain huddle, where we bring all four of those characters into communication, where we then gain the power to choose moment by moment who and how we want to be in the world. We do not have to be reactive. We do not have to be knee-jerk. We don't have to be in any way that we don't want to be. We have the power to choose. And that's, to me, what whole brain living is. It's a really beautiful book, I have to say.
You end the book with a brief chapter you call Tending the Garden.
Yes.
You got about a minute and a half. Can you share what, it's a lot of what you were just saying, but yeah. I'll let you end this talk the same way you ended that book, with tending the garden.
Well, tending the garden is, every ability we have is based on brain cells that perform that function. So I can move my fingers, or I can speak, or I can do anything because I have brain cells that are performing that function. And the thing about brain cells is that the more you focus on something, the stronger that circuit becomes. And you have to ask yourself, do I want more of this in my life? Do I like these thoughts? Do I like these ideas? Do I like hanging out with these people? What does it feel like when I'm around them? And actually making decisions based on, do I want more of this in my life? And if I do, then the more time I spend there, the stronger those circuits become. And then I gain a stronger ability to do those things. And I do want to end with one thing here, though, Terrence, is that it's what I call the 90-second rule. And the 90-second, because everything we have is in circuits, from the moment we think a thought, that's cells. It stimulates an emotional circuit. Those are cells. Then we run a physiological response to what we're thinking and feeling. And from the beginning, the moment we think a thought, until the physiology has flushed through us and flooded out of us, literally takes less than 90 seconds. So if I become angry, if that circuit gets triggered, then I can rant and rave, but it's usually over within 90 seconds. Now, a lot of people say, oh, Jill, I can stay angry for a whole lot longer than 90 seconds. But what you're doing is you're rethinking the thought, re-stimulating the emotional circuit, re-stimulating the physiological response over and over and over again.
You're saying that neurochemically it's over in 90 seconds unless we feed it. It's that old thing about which wolf, right?
That's exactly right. It is
the one you feed.
Right.
Okay, we've got to bring this to a close. Again, the books are My Stroke of Insight and Whole Brain Living, and you can learn more at drjilltaylor.com, drjilltaylor, all one word, for this conversation and many other interviews and articles. To join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally, all one word, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement, which I'll tell you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 8 or 10 articles that'll sort of flesh out the conversation, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com. And I just realized that I looked last week and signing up at my site is not obvious right now. I've got to get back to that. But obviously, I'm preoccupied these days, so I may not get back to it in the next couple of days. So email me if you want to get that email announcement, temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, most major podcast sites. You'll find years of podcasts at my sites. Michael Lewis, Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle. You can also follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to Kiana Williams in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. And finally, thank you, Jill Taylor, and keep up your good work.
Thank you so much, Terrence. I appreciate it. And hugs and kisses to your wife.
Very well. This was really, I really appreciate you responding so quickly to my request. And this has been so fulfilling. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, dear.
Thank you.
Take good care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Stephanie Miller. Here's what we're talking about. I believe Chris Murphy sincerely wants to stop at least one Sandy Hook family from happening again, right? Matthew McConaughey,
yes,
whatever you think, I don't even know what he is politically, but whatever he is, I think he spoke as a human and a father.
Yeah.
And, he was describing families who told him about their children. One father recalled his love of spoiling his daughter. There was a promise of taking her to SeaWorld. McConaughey said it would never happen. He said, we've got to get some real courage and honor our immortal obligations instead of our party affiliations. Again, only one party blocking it.
Yep.
He said, especially on this issue, America, you and me, we are not as divided as we're being told we are. That is true, Karen, again. But to just keep pointing out, the vast majority of Americans are on the Democrats' side on this issue. right? What other issue in American politics do you see where 90% is for something that one party is blocking? Only this issue, right?
Absolutely. This is a personal issue. It is not about politics at all. And you're right. I mean, when 90% of Americans want this, then, you know, my question to Republicans who continue to vote for these people who are, you know, basically allowing our children. I mean, never mind, like, if you have to go, if you go through, a shooting like this, that is, I mean, it's horrible. And every single community that goes through these, they all have the same thing in common. They didn't think it would ever happen there. Yeah. Meanwhile, there's a whole bunch of other communities that are having to subject their children, their young children, to active shooter drills.
Yeah.
Yep. Why is it that my son,
we're really long.
Yeah, my son knew exactly what to do. It's insane.
It's heartbreaking.
We have to stop it.
Find the Stephanie Miller Show every Monday through Friday at 9 to noon Eastern, 6 to 9 Pacific, right here on Progressive Voices.